afternoon. Welcome back. This is Studio A on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. We're going to spend the next hour taking a look at the Siege of Vienna. October is the anniversary month of that event in 1529. The Siege of Vienna, Austria, by the Islamic Ottoman Empire, was the turning point of the Islamic invasions into Europe. The Serbs fell at Belgrade in 1521. Then the Hungarians fell. At least a significant portion of Hungary fell in 1526. And as Christendom's major strongholds collapsed one after another before the Muslim onslaught, fear was spreading across Europe about this Muslim incursion, and by 1529, Suleiman the Magnificent, the Turk, the sworn enemy of the Christian faith, had set out for Vienna in order to defeat Christianity and ultimately to subjugate it. Outnumbered, desperate, fearful, the Viennese implored the mercy of God in their protection, but for some reason, the great heads of Europe, the great heads of the countries, the Christian countries of Europe, seemed to ignore their pleas. Now, as this is going on in the backdrop, the Reformation is also taking place. So in context of the Siege of Vienna, today in this segment of Studio A, we take a look at that particular historical event and what effect, if any, it had on the Reformation. Joining me for this segment of the program, for this hour of the program, is Dr. Timothy Furnish. He's a historian, an Islamic expert in both history and theology. He is also a veteran of the United States Army, and you can follow his work. He blogs regularly at his website, MahdiWatch.org, but you can also find his work at Pajamas Media and History News Network. Tim, thanks for your time this afternoon. It's a great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Glad to be back, Roland.
First off, what interest did a Turk have in incurring his way up into Europe? What was there to be gained?
Well, it was both political and religious. And, you know, one thing I just wanted to remark at the outset was, you know, we Lutherans are very good, especially those of us that have been to seminary, at learning about the theological aspects of the Reformation. But a lot of people don't realize that the Reformation was very geopolitical. There was a lot going on besides just, you know, what happened with the 95 Theses and Luther nailing that up and then everything that came from that. There was a lot of other stuff going on around that was influenced by that, and that influenced how that played out. So why would the Ottoman sultans over in Istanbul be interested in Western Europe? Well, two reasons. One is, of course, the Ottoman sultans were the leaders of not just the Sunni Islamic world, but they really sort of considered themselves the leaders of the entire Islamic world, although they had some enemies further to the east over there in Safavid Iran that begged to differ, and sometimes did more than beg. So besides that, however, the jihad, or as it was called in Turkish, Gazi or Gaza, holy warrior imperative to conquer Europe. The Ottomans, because they had taken over by 1453, they had taken over the entirety of what had been the Eastern Roman Empire. The Ottomans in many ways styled themselves as the successors to the Roman emperors. And as such, there was, believe it or not, sort of an operative ideology that the Ottomans were going to put the Roman Empire back together. This time, of course, it would be, you know, a new and improved version that would be Islamic. But there was an idea operative that lasted for some time, really down into probably the early 18th century, when it kind of got knocked out of them because of European military successes. But there was an operative idea for a century and a half, maybe two centuries, among the Ottoman leadership that they were going to bring back the Roman Empire. And that, of course, then would entail conquering what had been the old Western Roman Empire. So it was both religious and political.
Was Vienna really the gateway into Europe?
Well, I don't know if it's any more of a gateway than any other place might be. But if you're coming from southeastern Europe, I guess it's the largest city in. If you're an Ottoman Turk coming from the direction you're coming, it is the largest Christian city. So therefore, in that sense, it's sort of a gateway. I mean, that's rhetoric in a sense. I mean, would have been possible to bypass Vienna and go on into Europe, Central and Western and Northern Europe, probably. But, you know, the Ottoman sultans generally, not always, but generally were fairly well-trained in military matters, and they knew better than to go around an area that large with, you know, that much military potential and leave it on their flank unconquered.
So who are the players in this event? We mentioned Martin Luther. The Reformation is going on as a backdrop to this Islamic incursion. Who is Suleiman and Charles V, and what do they know of each other, and who else is involved in this?
Well, Well, Charles V, of course, is the Holy Roman Emperor, and, you know, as the joke goes, he ruled something that wasn't very holy and wasn't Roman and wasn't even really much of an empire.
Right.
It was basically Greater Germany. And, you know, whereas in the earlier medieval period, you had basically France. Basically, if you go back, you know, to 800 AD, it's Charlemagne, the largest polity in Europe post-fall of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century AD, was that cobbled back together by Charlemagne, the so-called Carolingian Empire, which is sometimes referred to as the Holy Roman Empire itself, but that is not accurate. The Carolingian Empire is really dependent just on one man, and that lasted for a few decades into the 9th century AD. But after that, it fell apart. The western part of it coalesced into a fairly viable nation-state, even in the medieval period, eventually becoming France. Then, of course, you have England up there, which is an island, which is sort of an exception in its own right. But the central and eastern parts of what have been Charlemagne's empire never really coalesced, to use that term again, into a successfully unified polity. And this really doesn't happen until the 19th century with Bismarck and with the Prussians. But you do have, it is, you know, the most populous part of Europe, and even then, in many ways, the city-states of what was later, or what about that time, was called the Hanseatic League, as well as the other polities, basically were under the nominal control of what was in some ways sort of an elected emperor. You know, we talk about Frederick the Elector of Saxony, right, when we get to Luther, who was Luther's prince, as it said. Seven of the most powerful leaders of the certain administrative divisions of the quote-unquote Holy Roman Empire, some of whom were ecclesiastical authorities, actually archbishops in the Catholic Church, were electors, and they got to choose who would be the next emperor. I mean, it wasn't, you know, democracy, but it was a sort of a unique system. I mean, this wasn't how the King of France or the King of England was chosen, but this is how this guy was chosen. So Charles happened to have been the King of Spain. Good Catholic, and since the Holy Roman Empire was officially Catholic, he was chosen also as the Holy Roman Emperor. So he is, on paper at least, the most powerful Christian monarch in Europe. All, you know, the King of France, who right around this time, shortly thereafter, will be Francis, is maybe not agreeing with that, but the King of France may not agree with that. The King of Spain may not agree with that. At this period, the kings and queens of England aren't too powerful, but they will be in short order. So he is certainly, I think, the on paper, and then if you look at the map in terms of what territories he ruled, again, some of it more in sort of theory than reality, the Holy Roman Emperor was the most powerful Christian ruler, and not just in Europe, but in the world, because remember, we are here in the mid-16th century, somewhat 60 years into post-Columbus, and Christianity is being transplanted to the New World and to other places. At this point, it's mainly Catholicism that's been transplanted, mainly by the Spanish and the Portuguese. But Christianity still, you know, 95%, I dare say, of the world's Christians are in Europe at this time, quite unlike our time. So again, the most powerful ruler, the most powerful Christian ruler, not just in Europe, but on the planet, would be Charles V. On the other hand, over there in the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Empire is arguably at this time, with the possible exception of, you know, the dynasties, any particular dynasty ruling in China at the time, probably the most powerful ruler on the face of the planet. Happens to be Muslim, of course. The Ottoman Turks had converted to Islam probably sometime in the 1200s, and as you went up through the 1300s and 1400s, built a large empire in what had been former Byzantine Christian territory in Anatolia, what is now Turkey. And as the years went by, they made it larger and larger, conquered Greece, came back over into basically Asia and conquered Constantinople in 1453. So, and that was under Mehmed II, or Muhammad II, the so-called conqueror, of course, because he's the one who took Constantinople. But by the time we get to the 16th century, the sultan is a fellow named Suleiman, or Solomon, basically, from the Bible. Shows up in the Quran as Suleiman. And he is probably the most, one of the most, if not the most, determined sultans in terms of conquest. In fact, there were even some messianic views about Suleiman. Basically, there were some Turks that even believed this guy was the Mahdi, you know, the eschatological figure that will make the whole world Muslim. So as part and parcel of that whole imperative, and you know, quite sure of himself because he had won a lot of battles, Suleiman decides that he is going to complete basically what had failed. If you go back to basically the 8th century AD, when in the initial wave of Islamic expansion, Muslims had conquered, what we like to say they conquered Spain and Portugal, but Spain and Portugal didn't exist yet. They conquered the Iberian Peninsula, which was Christian, and, of course, ruled there for 700 years. And again, that may have been one of the motivations for Suleiman doing what he did, because in 1492, again, the same year that Columbus, you know, found America, that was the year that the last Muslim state in the Iberian Peninsula, Granada, was eliminated. And so Suleiman probably had some idea that he was going to redress, you know, sort of the Islamic losses in the West, far west of Europe, by making up for them by coming into Europe from another direction.
So were the Muslims under Suleiman honorable warriors? I mean, we're finding a little bit of political correctness here, I understand, about how we perceive these events, much like the Crusades are misperceived as to who was the aggressor and who was the defender. Tell me how the Turk conducted himself in battle, especially as he went up into Christian Europe.
Well, I think in this period, I think a lot of the alleged Ottoman excesses are probably propaganda. Suleiman and the other Ottoman sultans ruled an empire that, you know, basically was on three continents. It was centered, of course, in Turkey, what is now Turkey, but it was in Europe. They ruled most of the Middle East, except for Iran, and they ruled parts of Africa. I mean, they had conquered Egypt in 1517, 1516, and had extended their power across into Libya and were moving across North Africa. So, again, as part of that imperative, as I said earlier, to sort of recreate the Roman Empire. So as an interesting aside there, you'll often hear the propaganda these days that Muslims don't fight other Muslims. Well, that would have been news to the Muslims that the Ottomans conquered. But anyway, my point is that probably in this period, in the 16th century, probably a good 20 to 25, maybe 30% of the Ottoman Empire was non-Muslim. It was huge minorities of Christians in the Middle East, and much more so, of course, in the recently conquered southeastern European areas. And so it would not have been very smart politics, very smart rulership for Ottoman sultans to let their armies basically rape and pillage, you know, as a policy. I'm sure some of that happened. And it tended to be sort of the Middle Eastern imperative, going back, you know, really for thousands of years, really in many ways predating the Muslims, that if, you know, if an area submitted, they would be treated much more, much better, much more nicely, if you will, than if they resisted. So there's probably some of that. I mean, we do have clear examples in the 16th century and up into the early 17th century of the Ottomans conquering territories and doing things like Armenians, for instance, moving up into territories in what is now between Turkey and Russia, and ordering people to convert, and then when they don't convert, their heads are chopped off en masse sometimes. We do have examples of that, and there was examples even against the Western European Christians, against the Catholic strongholds in the Mediterranean, where the on Cyprus and Crete and other places where the Ottomans would take a garrison. Famous example of in Crete, where the Ottomans promised safe conduct if the garrison would surrender, and when they did, the Ottoman commander basically beheaded all the men, and the ones that he didn't behead, the people that weren't beheaded were taken into slavery. But then it turned out that the commander that did this was punished very severely by the Sultan when the Sultan found out about it. Because if for no other reason, Sultans tended to know, as I was saying, that you really don't want to alienate 30% of your population by doing stupid things like this. So did it go on? Yes. I'm not sure that it went on any more in the 15th, 16th century than it did, you know, as we get to, you know, the 30 Years' War from 1680 to 1648, when Protestants and Catholics were killing each other en masse and did a lot of that stuff to each other. I'm not sure the Ottomans did it any more than them in the 16th century.
And as a result of what you're saying, Tim, that's why we have blonde, blue-eyed Bosnian Muslims running around today. And further to your point, the invitation, other than not dying, which is a pretty good incentive if you ask me, but other than not being killed in some grotesque and horrible way, what benefit did this capitulation bring?
Well, there were pretty light-skinned sultans, for that matter, because many of the sultans took wives from places like Albania and, you know, Romania and places like that. So there were a number of very important princes and even sometimes sultans in the Ottoman Empire that were, they were very light-skinned, and I'm not sure they had blue eyes, but they probably could have easily walked the streets of, you know, London or New York and not turned a head if they'd probably, you know, taken their turban off. I think the Ottomans were sort of a strange mix of customary sort of Central Asian Turco-Mongol law, which is, again, the Turks are related to the Mongols. They came originally from Central Asia, moved into the region of what is now Turkey, what was then, you know, the Byzantine Empire as it was falling apart in, you know, sometime after about the year 900-1000 AD. But they were very heavily imbued with, again, Central Asian sort of Turco-Mongol tradition. And once they converted to Islam, they would fuse that with Islamic beliefs. And then, of course, by the time we get to the 14th century and up into the 15th century, when the Ottoman Turks, who are a specific tribe of Turks, sort of supplant any of the others and create the empire, you know, they become pretty savvy rulers. And, you know, as I was pointing out earlier, they knew better than to alienate huge minorities of the population. On the other hand, they were very clear that it was an Islamic state, an Islamic rule, Islamic, you know, it wouldn't be the harsh Sharia law that you have in a place like Saudi Arabia today or something, but Islamic law was the law of the land. The difference, again, was that the Ottomans had these huge, what they called millets, M-I-L-L-E-T-S, from the Arabic word millah, which means nation. These huge millets of minorities, most of whom were Christian, who were basically allowed to sort of practice their own, use their own laws in their own communities. They were, of course, second-class citizens, and the usual rubrics applied, for the most part, in terms of social mobility and advancement. But for instance, the Janissaries, who were the shock troops of the Ottoman Empire, were basically all young Christian kids taken from Eastern Europe or from, they were Circassians taken from what is now basically Southern Russia, taken back to Istanbul, converted to Islam, and taught, given a very good education. You know, in fact, there are records of, you know, Christian families wanting their kids to be, you know, rather than spend their life, you know, picking lice out of their hair in the hut that they lived in somewhere north of the Black Sea. They would be going to basically the New York or the London of the day, getting an education, you know, getting three squares a day and an occasional bath and getting trained in something, generally the military, of course. And in fact, the Ottoman Empire allowed a convert to Islam could become any office in the land except for Sultan. The Sultan, of course, had to be born of a Muslim and from the royal house of Osman of the Ottoman family. But basically, the Grand Vizier position, for many, many episodes in Ottoman history, the Grand Vizier, who was basically more or less the prime minister, in a sense, of the Ottoman Empire, was very often a converted Christian. So it was, again, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. I mean, Ottoman historians tend to sort of like really love their topic and sort of, I think, sometimes lose their objectivity about this empire, which is very fascinating in many ways and is very unlike in many ways the so-called Islamic fundamentalists of our day. But it was nonetheless an Islamic state. So anyway, to go back to the gravamen of your question, one of the aspects of being an Islamic state is when you're invading someone, particularly a land of another people of the book, Jews or Christians, and since Jews didn't have any states back then, the only people you're invading who are other fellow people of the book are Christians, you're supposed to invite them to convert, right, to the true religion. You know, sometimes it's a sort of pro forma, and with some sultans, you know, it would be like, hey, we invite you to convert, and now the attack commences. you know, it's not, it was really sort of a joke almost, but for other sultans, it was a very serious thing, and they would observe all the proper, you know, they consult with the clerics and the mufti of Istanbul, and, you know, how long do I have to give them, and that sort of thing, and then if they agree to it, what are the rubrics for that, but you know, again, on the other side, Christians knew that this wasn't always honored, as I pointed out earlier, and also pious Christians knew that converting to Islam wasn't, and yes, even our Catholic brothers and sisters knew this in the 16th century, that converting to Islam is probably not a good way to assure your entrance into heaven. So this was generally rejected out of hand.
Now, simultaneously, you have Charles V. The Viennese are pleading for help. The Austrians are begging for help. How does Charles V respond? And talking about the sort of response to the siege, why didn't the monarchs of Europe, why didn't the great heads of state show more interest in coming to the aid of the Austrians?
Well, 1529. So the Reformation's been in full swing here for 12 years. Worms was in 1521.
Right.
A substantial number of Charles V's subjects were Protestants, particularly Lutherans at this period, who are still pretty much the only Protestant game in town because Calvinism hasn't gotten going yet. Yeah, Zwingli floating around over there, right? But, you know, not nearly as powerful. So you had that going on inside of his empire. And the other thing was that, again, Charles is worried about particularly the French, because the French are particularly worried too, because remember, Charles had been the king of Spain. So the French, although they're also co-religionist Catholics, along with Charles and the Spanish and the majority of well, I don't want to say Holy Romans, the Germans more or less, France is in between, so France has got its own problems. I mean, you, throughout the 16th century and up into the 17th, there are examples of the French king making diplomatic overtures to the Ottomans, you know, who should be the sworn enemy of a Christian ruler, right?
Well, you'd think so, yeah.
But the French, you know, it's realpolitik. The French realize, hey, you know, our bigger enemy right now is Charles V, because we're worried about him gobbling up France. By the same token, on the other side of the fence, Charles has a domestic religious insurrection going on. He's getting pressure from the Pope because he's not taking care of it like they think he should be. And, you know, Vienna is way down there on sort of the margins. And I think a lot of what's going on, you know, why he doesn't send more troops is that he just frankly... He's just preoccupied with what's going on in his lands and with the traditional enemy there, which would be France, and not really sort of facing up to the fact that the Ottomans really are a serious threat.
So he just doesn't realize that, well, I find it hard to understand how someone who rises to that level, well, maybe I should be careful considering how people get elected, doesn't see that kind of a threat, that if they take Vienna, they don't stop there. That's not enough.
Well, you know, he may have figured that he had time to, you know, get his army together, and if that indeed came to pass, that he would have time to get his army together and stop the Ottomans. I mean, maybe he figured that. Maybe he figured if that happened, you know, that the other Catholic rulers of Europe would come in, particularly the French, would come in on his side. You know, England is still Catholic at this point, right?
Right.
So he also maybe figured that that Henry would help. So I don't know. But, you know, he obviously really didn't send very much help, or didn't send help at all in a sense.
Let's hold up for a moment because we're at the bottom of the segment here, and I want to come back and deal with that because we still have to work our way up to what, if any, effect this had on the Reformation. And perhaps you'd also want to talk a little bit about why Luther refers to the Turk as the schoolmaster of Europe. This is Studio A on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. Dr. Timothy Furnish is my guest. Check out his website, ModiWatch.org. We'll be back after these few short announcements. Stick around.
Worldwide KFUO salutes our day's sponsor on this Saturday, October 19th, 2013. Today's day sponsors are John and Janet Rao. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO in celebration of John and Janet Rao's 38th wedding anniversary. Once again, we say thank you to John and Janet Rao of St. Charles, Missouri, today's Worldwide KFUO day sponsor.
338!
Protect yourself and those around you by getting your flu vaccine. It is your best defense against the flu. Annual vaccination against flu is recommended for all people 6 months of age and older, unless they have a condition or medical reason not to get the vaccine. Stay in the game, get vaccinated, and help us tackle the flu.
To find a flu vaccine clinic near you, go to mo.gov and click on the flu vaccine locator. This message is brought to you by the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services.
In 2017, Christianity will celebrate the 500th year of the Lutheran Reformation. In anticipation of this worldwide event, Worldwide KFUO is proud to present New York Metropolitan Opera star Janet Hopkins in a musical drama as told from the mind of Katharina von Bora Luther. This modern opera is performed in English. The music is melodic and fresh. Composer Dr. Glenn Winters has masterfully woven Lutheran hymnody into the score, which makes for an exciting work of art that faithfully represents Katie Luther and the Reformation. This must-see performance will be Friday, October 25th, 7 p.m. at Concordia Seminary in Clayton. For tickets, go to www.itickets.com and search for Katie Luther, or by phone at 800-965-9324. That's 800-965-9324.
Our mission at KFUO is to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ to the nations. Today's internet capabilities give us the opportunity to do that. Listeners from all over the world can follow the ministry of KFUO via our website, Facebook, Wi-Fi radios, and smartphone apps. You can listen to KFUO Radio 24 hours a day, anywhere, with our on-demand programs and live audio streams. Worldwide KFUO at KFUO.org.
On the next Joy, Bach, a cantata which contains music that Bach loved so much, he used it again in the famous B minor Mass. Plus hymns, spirituals, anthems, and a single cello playing 16 parts. Yes, we're all multitasking these days. This is Ron Clem, inviting you to join us this week for Joy.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on Worldwide KFUO.
Welcome back. This is Studio A on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. We continue our discussion now with Dr. Timothy Furnish about the Siege of Vienna and the impact it had, or perhaps didn't have, on the Reformation, which is the backdrop to the Muslim incursions into Central Europe. Tim, thanks for sticking around for this half of the program. As we went to the break, we were talking about the sort of response the great heads of Europe, the great Christian heads of Europe, well, the lack of response, probably the better way to put it, they had to the pleas for help from the Austrians and the Viennese. Why didn't the monarchs of Europe show greater concern about A, the Muslims, and B, the plight of the Viennese?
Well, we were talking about why Charles didn't basically pull out all stops to help with the Siege of Vienna, and I was saying I don't know that there's a good answer for that. It probably had a lot to do with, again, he was probably more concerned with what was going on within his own lands. In terms of the Reformation and the pressure he was getting from the Pope to deal with that, Machiavellian political maneuvering going on. I mean, the Catholic rulers of Europe really don't get their act together vis-a-vis the Ottomans until 1571. And 1571, of course, is the famous naval battle of Lepanto. You know, the Protestants didn't help very much with that, but it was basically the combined Catholic navies of Europe that stopped the massive Ottoman naval. In fact, I think there were, if I remember correctly, something like 600 Ottoman ships against about 300 European ones, and it was the largest naval battle, I believe, until World War II. But the Ottomans basically massed a huge flotilla to invade Italy, and they were smashed by the navies of the Spanish and French and Venice. But that's, you know, what, 50 years in the future from this. So the Catholic rulers of Europe, and Charles is one of these, basically are dealing, it's almost like, in a sense, they're sort of caught in these cobwebs of politics, and it's hard, or maybe cobwebs isn't strong enough, tendrils, vines of politics, and a lot of them come from the Vatican, because the popes really don't have the political power they had in the medieval period, but they still are able to sort of gum up the works, and basically, you know, they still wield the power of excommunication and theological. They sort of hold the theological sword over the rulers of Europe, and I think that has a lot to do with gumming up the works in a sense. So Suleiman attacks Vienna, and you know had really good success earlier. In the decade or so before that, in the rest of southeastern Europe, and probably figured he would again, but you know he wasn't quite as fortunate this time.
Tim, as a former military guy, I want to ask you this question. I just find this sort of interesting as a sidebar. When Suleiman arrives at the gates of Vienna, how do you go about sieging? How do you go about attacking and conquering a fortified medieval city with great walls and great ramparts, even though they may not have been in the best of shape, even though the troops inside may not have been in large enough number? This cannot be an easy task, can it?
Well, it's a very difficult task if you don't have heavy artillery. And the Turks had not managed to get their heavy artillery up, on this campaign, largely because it was extraordinarily, according to the records, extraordinarily bad rainy season. And I guess southeastern Central Europe is pretty rainy anyway that time of year, but basically it was even worse than ever. And so the wagons with the Ottoman heavy artillery really didn't make it. The Ottomans brought, for some inexplicable reason, brought a considerable number of camels, although the Janissaries normally fought on horseback and the Ottoman cavalry fought on horseback. But they brought a bunch of camels, which, of course, didn't do well and got sick, plus a lot of the Ottoman troops got sick. So it was very bad all around, although we don't know exactly. I mean, the chroniclers say anywhere between 120 to 300,000 troops, certainly more than they had manning the garrison in Vienna. But these cities were heavily fortified, especially after, you know, the relief forces got there under Somme, and they basically more massively fortified the walls from inside, built ramparts, did a lot of things to make the city even more impregnable. So if you don't have heavy artillery, sieges don't work very well. And this is really one of the major reasons the Ottomans failed at Vienna, at the siege of Vienna.
With the rain, now this can go one of two different ways, so we're going to really put you to the test here, Tim. What do you think about the weather conditions? Was this just a bad call on the part of Suleiman to fight at this time of year in a place that gets real wet in September and October? Was there an act of providence going on, or was this perhaps just a lucky break for the Austrians?
Well, I would say yes to all the above.
Why would you say yes and not pick a side of that?
Well, I'm tempted to say God helps those who help themselves, but really they didn't have much to do with the rainy season, did they? excuse me. I mean, you know, as a historian, I'm loath to invoke divine intervention for certain things because some people tend to invoke it way too often.
Oh, yeah.
On the other hand, you know, it's clear from biblical history that, you know, that God uses, that God can use natural events, natural processes in ways to deliver his people. And sometimes it is just flat out a miracle. I don't think we have to go quite to the miraculous with this, because it wasn't that they invaded at a time of year when it didn't normally rain and it massively rained. They invaded at a time of year when it's pretty darn wet in that part of Europe. So was it wetter than usual? Yes. I tend to chalk this up to really sort of bad decisions on the part of Suleiman and his general staff. I think they had had so much success against European armies that, with not without reason, that they thought that it wouldn't be that hard. But when the rain just incessantly kept coming, and a lot of their troops got sick, and they couldn't get their heavy artillery up there, somebody should have realized. And and again, this is a seasoned army. These guys have been conquering people for, 80 years at least. I mean, obviously, not these exact guys, but, institutionally, this is an army that knows what it's doing, okay? I mean, today we tend to look at, Middle Eastern armies as being rather inept and they lose every war they fight. And, that's maybe the case here in the 20th and 21st century, but it wasn't the case in the 16th century. In the 15th century, the Ottomans were probably the foremost military power on the planet. So it was, you could see where they might figure, well, these are just some bumps in the road. We can overcome these because we've always overcome them before. But one thing that's really striking about the Siege of Vienna, and remember, it's basically, the Siege of Vienna is sort of a, it's kind of a Two Towers thing, it's Lord of the Rings. It's not offensive on the part of European Christians. Obviously, they're just holed up in Vienna, and they hold off. It's like Helm's Deep in the Two Towers movie. They hold off the invasion, the besiegers. It's not till we get to later on, when the so-called Battle of Vienna, when they turn the tide, and they actually do offensively destroy a large portion of the Ottoman army. And again, as I mentioned, with the Battle of Lepanto, which is the big naval battle. In that sense, in the sense that I guess it's really probably accurate to say, for the first time a Christian city successfully holds off, a large Christian city successfully holds off a large, determined Ottoman Muslim army, it does mark a turning point of sorts. I would argue that really the big turning point where things start going south for the Ottomans and start going the other direction for European Christian militaries is not until, the Battle of Vienna later, and I said post-Lepanto, of course. But I think here, in terms of just pure politics, in terms of, expansion of one civilization at the expense of another, what was Churchill's famous phrase? It may not be the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning. This is really the end of the beginning, because the Ottomans, after this unsuccessful siege, aren't seen as invincible as they used to be. So, and then, of course, where this plays into, of course, with the Reformation, should we talk about that?
Well, I had one other question for you.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Before we get to the impact on the Reformation.
All right.
Suleiman, how he comes to bear the title Magnificent, you can explain if it helps. But this incursion into Europe, this conquest, were they fighting on behalf of Allah? Were they fighting to expand Islam? Or was this just one of these grand hubristic adventures that, these great leaders go on occasionally?
Again, yes. It's not either or, it's both and. I mean, there probably hasn't been a bigger ego in the history of the Ottoman Empire, and that's some pretty big egos if you look at the turbans those guys wore.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those turbans had their own gravitational fields. but, wasn't a bigger ego than Suleiman. It's the reason they called him the Magnificent, than him. But he also believed, as did, all of at least the sober Ottoman sultans, of which there were not a few of the other kind, believe that, he was doing Allah's will. Now, Allah's will was, of course, to make him rich and famous and give him a large, large harem. Being rich and famous and having a large harem and doing Allah's will were not seen as, mutually exclusive by these guys.
I'm just trying to discern if this is a clash of powers or a clash of religions, and I bet you're going to say both.
You're very perceptive, Roland.
After the two previous questions, it's an easy answer.
Well, I think you have to see it as both. I mean, it's clearly both. I mean, the thing, again, it's taught in seminaries, and at least it was when I was there, which was a few years ago. But, it tends to be taught in seminaries and in Sunday school and our catechism classes. It's you know, it's all religious and theological. And, of course, that's very, very important, and that's the most important part to us as individual believers. But that's not all it was about. I mean, God works in history, you know? I mean, it's clear in the Old Testament, and it's clear maybe not in the New Testament in terms of macro, but, you know, as we learn about the development of the early church and, I mean, you know, how did Christianity become the world's largest religion? Well, it wouldn't have been if it hadn't been adopted by the Roman Empire, frankly.
Right.
So, you know, I think God works through history. He's not exclusive of history. And so you really have to see what's going on here as both religious and political.
Well, the reason I'm progressing that way is because then you have to bring the Reformation into this. And Luther has that famous comment about the Turk being the schoolmaster of Europe. And I'm wondering if there's a comparison, if what you're just saying plays into what Luther says, because if you look at Romans, if you go back into Exodus, you see where God says that he raised up Pharaoh to serve his greater purpose. And did Luther see Suleiman and this incursion the same way?
I think Luther saw the Ottomans like the Assyrians, that basically, you know, a rod to chastise Christians for, you know, having, you know, submitted, I guess, in a sense, to the onerous Catholic yoke for so many years, and really, to, you know, chastise the Catholic powers, because they were the ones that, you know, from Luther's point of view, you know, I mean, the Pope was Antichrist to Luther. So, you know, it's interesting, though, because if you look at sort of Luther and Calvin on this issue, I mean, Luther basically, Luther had sometimes written rather approvingly of the Turks, you know, although I don't think he ever met a Muslim in his life. And Luther was one of these guys that said, well, you know, what I've read of them sounds, you know, they have a wrong religion, but at least they live it out, unless, you know, which kind of Luther would sometimes contrast with the way a lot of people were in Europe with their Catholicism, certainly. You know, Calvin, on the other hand, never had a good thing to say ever about the Turks. And Luther also tended to be, again, and I think this reflects really the division a lot of us already know of that there was between Luther and Calvin. And to this day, the division between, in some sense, Calvinist Reformed churches and our Lutheran churches. Calvin was much more political about this. He thought that there needed to be a political military, you know, response to the Turks, and Luther tended not to think that was the case. I mean, it was interesting. I mean, he sort of, Luther's views kind of went back and forth on that issue, but he tended to think, I think, much less, you know, in terms of like the people in Europe, the Christians in Europe would be delivered if they would get right with God and, you know, get right, you know, with read the Bible and get right with salvation by grace through faith, instead of hanging on to the, you know, idolatry of the Catholic Church. And Calvin tended to think more that, well, you know, we really need a big Christian army to deal with the Turks. So, of course, Calvin was a little bit later than Luther, too, so that probably played into it. But, you know, in terms of the whole big geopolitical picture, you know, it's pretty clear, I think, that although we talked a moment ago about Henry the Sixth flashback, Henry the Sixth, Henry the Eighth, Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, really didn't seem to get the threat from the Turks or from the Ottomans, at least initially, or didn't seem to deem it as big a problem for him as, you know, his internal problems with the Protestants and his problems with the King of France over to his west. I think that later Charles did get it. And, you know, I mean, it's hard not to get it when the Ottomans, you know, keep invading your territories. You know, they invade to the northwest, and then it's really hard to ignore any armies that are marching toward you. Excuse me. So I think that eventually what happened was that they saw that the Ottomans were a major threat, and then Charles then responded, you know, in concert with some of the other Catholic rulers to try to do something about it. And, you know, then that gave breathing room to the Reformation, because at that point, the sort of it flips. Instead of ignoring the Ottomans and worrying about, the internal threat, both political and religious, because people forget that the Reformation was religious, if only inadvertently, at that time, because everything religious was political. So instead of worrying, instead of ignoring the Ottoman threat, worrying only about the internal threat posed by the Reformation, Charles, it kind of goes the other way. And so he's like, well, tells the Lutherans, stop causing problems for me and don't refuse to enlist in the army and that sort of thing, because I may need men to fight the Ottomans. And I will let you practice your strange Protestant brand of Christianity, even though the Pope's not happy with me. So I think it's clear. And then you see there are specific examples. There were a couple of examples, interestingly enough, though, where there were some examples of Protestants in places like Transylvania and some other places down in that direction, actually allying with the Ottomans over against their own Catholic ruler. And there's also some sources indicating that by the time we get a little bit later into the 16th century, when Elizabeth becomes Queen of England, and remember, England went back and forth between Protestantism, Puritanism, and Catholicism, and then Elizabeth came to power, and it sort of settled down for a bit, and it became an officially Anglican country. Which, the Anglicans claim to be neither Catholic nor Protestant, but Anglican. Yeah, that's what they claim. At least they did in the 16th century. But there are accounts of, and there's some records that show that basically, Elizabeth was the first English ruler to send an ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. And they seem to have gotten along fairly well, with this long-distance diplomatic communication that they had going on. And I'd read up a little bit on this. Some of the correspondence between Elizabeth and the Ottoman sultans, it was Murat and I forget which other one it was. They would stress sort of the similarities between Protestantism and Islam over against Catholicism. We're against icons. We're against crucifixes and all those sort of scary things. Which much more sort of Unitarian monotheists than the Catholics with their idolatry are. And so that sort of thing kind of went back and forth between the Ottoman sultans and Queen Elizabeth in England. So, and the Ottomans on their part saw, look, again, our biggest enemy in Europe seems to be the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And therefore, anything we could do to sort of like, stick a shiv into them in reality or diplomatically, we'll go along with. So, the Ottoman sultans really didn't know much about this place called England, but they figured, hey, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So it never really came to a it never really came to a military alliance, but there was great increase in like economic trade and commerce between England and the Ottomans at this period. So that gave whoever the Holy Roman Emperor was, Charles and his successor, another thing to worry about. There's England up there. Okay, so the Ottomans were playing on their side. Were playing basically Machiavellian geopolitical games. I guess really it's not accurate to call them games. This was maneuvering. This was life and death stuff to try to influence. Particularly Protestant rulers in Europe to be on their side over against the Catholic rulers. On the other side, some of the Protestants in Europe, and remember how this shakes out eventually. Basically what you wind up with by mid to late 16th century is the Holy Roman Empire is officially Catholic, although large pockets of it, of course, are Lutheran, right?
Right.
France is Catholic, Spain is Catholic, but the French really don't like the Holy Roman Empire or the Spanish, because they're in between. England is sort of Protestant, definitely not Catholic. Denmark, Sweden, and people forget Sweden becomes a major military power in the 16th century up into the 17th century under Gustavus Adolphus. For about 100 years or so, maybe a little longer, Sweden is a major military power. So all these people are jockeying for position vis-a-vis the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottomans still are, even though after the Siege of Vienna, arguably on a downward swing, or maybe they've sort of reached their apex and don't get any higher. The Ottomans are still the major military power in Europe, and they are in Europe. And on the other side of the fence, the Ottomans are trying to influence, win friends and influence people and punish enemies and take advantage of the Reformation as much as they can.
So ultimately, we've got about 2 minutes left here. So ultimately, at the end of the day, the Reformation benefits from the Siege of Vienna and ultimately the presence of the Turk, or, well, you tell me, what do you think?
Yes, I think ultimately, I think it's safe to say, sort of macro picture, in the 16th century and even up into the 17th century, the Reformation benefits from Ottoman incursions into Europe, ironically enough. Because, I was reading an article earlier by an economist that says, these economists always say that things are more, I think, empirical than they really are, but who's done an empirical study of the period from the early 1400s up to about 1699, the conflicts, and has some interesting data that indicates that basically every time the Ottomans invaded, and there were, of course, more invasions than that one attempt to besiege Vienna, but every time the Ottomans invaded into Europe or threatened, I should say, further into Europe, because remember, they did already rule Greece and the Balkans and part of Hungary. Hungary was basically divided. They ruled part of Hungary. Was now Bulgaria. So anytime the Ottomans either invaded or threatened to invade further into Europe, it reduced conflicts among Europeans, particularly Catholic versus Protestant conflicts. So I think it's a very, very good case can be made that the Ottomans, the Ottoman Muslim Turks, ironically, actually helped the Reformation.
I think the point that you make, Tim, that's worthy of consideration. We do forget, and thank you for commending it to our memory again, that God does work in history, and the Siege of Vienna, the Battle of Vienna, is proof of that.
Oh, I think if you look at the whole span there for 150, 200 years, that get, like I said, up through the actual Battle of Vienna in the late 17th century, and of course, the Battle of Lepanto, or if you want to go back on the other end, booking it on the other end, a couple weeks ago was the anniversary of the Battle of Tours or Poitiers, right, in 732 AD, when an invading Arab Muslim army from North Africa was up into south central France and was stopped by the army of Charles Martel with his, as I love it, his heavy axe throwing Frankish infantry.
That's right.
Was that just a secular example of one side having a good military day, or was God at work in that? Well, I think that if you look at the possible repercussions that would have come from that, which would have been Paris would probably, have been Muslim by the mid-8th century AD, and perhaps points further north might have been. If you look at that, I think, and perhaps sometimes we can only see this in retrospect, but I think it's clear that it was certainly not God's will that the Muslims conquer France.
And that also ultimately winds up setting up the dynasty of, well, we in Germany like to refer to him as Karl der Große, but Charlemagne.
Right. Chuck the Great.
Dr. Timothy Furnish, good friend of the program, regular here. We were talking about the Siege of Vienna, its impact on the Reformation. You can follow his work at his website, mottiwatch.org. Any other sources, Tim, you want to direct folks to?
Nope, that's good for now.
That's good for now. Thank you, Tim. All the best. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. Thanks.
Thank you, my friend.